All right, here we go. So, I hope everyone is doing well, and hope everyone's looking forward to a restful and relaxing and meaningful Thanksgiving. I'm a big fan of Thanksgiving from a Jewish perspective. I think it was it last year, I think we did a shiur at the dairy, which has not been reopened in time, but for this year. But talking about how actually the story of the initial Thanksgiving arose out of a Christian Bible that came over on the Mayflower that was inscribed, among other things, with, believe it or not, the rulings of the Rambam, of Maimonides, around the obligation of Thanksgiving for someone who survives a difficult period, a dangerous period. For example, traveling by ship over an ocean. And this particular halakha, which the Rambam really is codifying on the basis of Gemara in Masechet Brachot, which itself derives from the Todah sacrifice, from one of the Korbanot, that this particular sacrifice actually becomes the source not only for the Rambam's ruling, but then in turn for the decision of a number of those, that initial community that came over on the Mayflower to celebrate those pilgrims, to celebrate that initial Thanksgiving. And in fact, as they were dedicating and celebrating this particular Thanksgiving, it's very clear that in the preaching that surrounded that original festivity, they actually turned back to the Rambam's ruling, which had been inscribed into this popular Bible that had come over, and that was actually part of the inspiration for the initial Thanksgiving. So it's not only that the motif of giving Hakarat HaTov, of expressing thankfulness, is itself a profoundly Jewish value, which of course it is, but that the initial celebration, the American celebration of Thanksgiving, actually was directly influenced by and drawn from Jewish and even halachic sources, which is remarkable, but I think speaks quite profoundly to something that we know is true, which is that beyond the general notion of Jewish influence on Western civilization and all of that, actually there is a more immediate kind of impact that our culture had, and that actually this is rife for a series of classes or a whole series of studies on this that some have begun, which is to look at the Jewish influences at the time before the founding of the United States of America, around the time of the founding fathers. There's some fantastic literature on this subject. Rabbi Meir Soloveitchik, who visited here earlier this year, is a big fan of some of this material, and I also have a real interest in this. He's done some publishing around these themes, and I always think around this time of year of the history that we have here in the city of Philadelphia. We have an unbelievably rich history in terms of American Jewish history, our heritage. I don't know if he was able to make it, but what Rev Shalom, who was just here over Shabbat, was he had some extra time on Sunday during the day before his flight back home. We were trying to figure out what he might do with his time, and we actually spoke about it. I want to check in with him. I'm going to send him an email and see if he made it. But he was actually thinking about it. He said, wow, there's this Liberty Bell. He had never heard of these things, believe it or not, when he was raised in Ethiopia to age 9. He could not believe it. I told him about the Pasuk in Parshat Behar, and I said, you know, this Pasuk, Ukraten Deror Baretz Yoshmeha, you shall call out liberty. And I said, there's this American bell, and it actually is inscribed with the pasuk from Parshat Behar. He's like, my goodness, lo yuman, how can it be that there's this American secular thing that has a pasuk from Kumar? It was like totally mind-blowing, where he had no idea, and it was just so fresh for him. So things that we kind of take for granted, someone who comes from a very distant culture and didn't necessarily have that embeddedness and that exposure, it really is remarkable. So we are, I think, blessed to have a lot of rich American history and Jewish history that is interwoven together at the museum and really in the city of Philadelphia.
I'm going to tell all the people I think it's Thanksgiving because it's not a Jewish holiday. What you say.
I will. You should please send it to them in my name, and I believe. And I want a little bit of social commentary. I saw this past week that there was in a prominent Jewish online publication that there was a Jewish author who published a screed against Thanksgiving. And it was exceedingly upsetting and really unacceptable. It is true. He did two things. Number one, he complained about his cooking and his family or something like that. And I feel badly for him, but I'm not sure that's basis on which to oppose Thanksgiving in general. I'm not sure that's what he meant. I think he's just being a kvetch. And in that sense, he is being quite Jewish. But then he talked about some of the genuine and problematic atrocities that did take place. And I think we have to be honest about those kinds of things, about the interactions between the earliest, what ultimately would become the Americans and the Native Americans. I think we have to be aware and sensitive to those. But that doesn't mean the fact that there were very problematic events that we have to be concerned about and think and hard about does not mean at the same time that we don't have a tremendous sense of gratitude that goes all the way back. I think you can hold both in our hands at the same time, be honest about the history, but also celebrate the great gifts that this country has given us and so many. And no one is perfect, and we know that in the case of Israel and in the case of America, but in neither instance is it as a reason to therefore throw out the baby with the bathwater. So unfortunately, there are currents like this. I appreciate where they come from, and I think they keep us honest, but at the same time, I think it's very important to celebrate and to appreciate. And I don't think there's an obligation to celebrate Thanksgiving, but I think it's a good thing to do, and I think it's an opportunity for reflection. So please tell it to them in my name. I'd be very proud to have it shared. Okay. All right, so last time we wrapped up our discussion of some of the end-of-life care. There is so much more to say, and we'll come back and touch on some of it. Louis, I know you were asking about the questions of providing nutrition, and I want to circle back to those in context of some of the future classes, so I haven't forgotten about those. To be honest, I'm still grappling with it myself, because I'm not sure I see it so clearly. So I'm thinking through these issues myself, so I hope to circle back, and we'll continue that conversation. But it was getting a little depressing for a while, so I decided it'd be good to get a change of pace. And this is a topic that is close to my heart and something that I really should think more seriously about, not just in a theoretical way, I'm happy to give a share, but in a personal way. I have family members, for example, who have donated not kidneys, but stem cells. My brother-in-law actually donated stem cells. It is an extremely painful procedure, from what I understand, but was impactful. It was very generous and very impactful. It made a real difference in someone's life. And I have people that I've been associated with, including rabbis, teachers, etc., who've donated kidneys. Including, I have a picture at the top here of an individual who became my parents' shul rabbi time I was in college. He took over. His name is Rabbi Larry Rothwax. So if you take a look at the second side, you will see a picture of Rabbi Larry Rothwax and someone by the name of Donny Heen. This is after Rabbi Rothwax donated him a kidney. He's not the only rabbi that I know who has donated a kidney. There are a number of them. There's a wonderful organization called Renewal through which he did some of his work. I also know rabbis who have benefited from, it's anyone, but I happen to know that Rabbi Yossi Adler, for example, in Tinek, was the rabbi of Congregation Rina Israel, Rina Yisrael, if anyone knows the name. Rabbi Adler was in need and was a recipient as well. So I have people with whom I have a relationship on both sides that have benefited from and given the gift of a kidney to others. And this is actually from a write-up that I shared a little bit of on the back of our source sheet. But I think this is an area of tremendous Kiddush Hashem, and I think it's worth reviewing the halachic issues. And I think this is not only an area of tremendous Kiddush Hashem, as we'll continue to highlight, but it's also an interesting case study of where the halachic ruling shifts, not because the halacha changes, but because medical science changes. The changes in living organ donation, as so many other areas of medicine, cannot be underestimated from when these surgeries were first available in the 1960s until 2017, and I'm sure 2018, 19, and 20, etc., will continue to change dramatically. When kidney donations, I'm just going to use that as an example, we'll talk mostly about kidney donations, but it's obviously not the only living organ opportunity that's available, but it is the one that has been subject to the greatest halachic literature, the one that is subject to the greatest risk, the best of my knowledge, or at least was in the initial days, and so has received a lot of the most robust discussion among the poskim. In the beginning, it was considered to be quite dangerous to undergo a kidney donation. It was not a guarantee that the donor would live, and on the flip side, it wasn't always a guarantee that it would be an effective operation. There were highly publicized instances in the early days of people who gave donations generously and then unfortunately suffered tremendously, or even ultimately in a small minority of cases passed away, and that has changed dramatically. The level of risk, both in terms of mortality and in terms of even complications, has gone down quite significantly, even dramatically. It remains not an entirely 100% safe operation. There is no such thing. We've discussed as a medical procedure that is not without its consequences, and that's certainly true. It remains true when it comes to living kidney donations. The other thing that's shifting is that the medical science is starting to move toward the possibility of other solutions for these challenges. There are discussions about, believe it or not, animal donations, organ donations that can be repurposed for human beings, xenotransplantation, that is a field of medicine that is progressing. That raises a host of halachic questions. Is this a human heart? Okay, let's say I take animal, we can't do this yet, obviously. Let's say I take a whole host of animal organs and I transplant them into a human being. What is the definition of what it means to be a human being? If I take an animal brain and an animal heart, and so forget the kidney for a second, but these sorts of vital organs, and I transplant them successfully, we're not there yet, but into a human being.
Well, some parts are.
Right?
Some parts are there.
Right? What does it mean to even be human? These are like the AI kinds of questions, artificial intelligence questions. These are questions that medical ethicists are beginning to grapple with, and not just Jewish ones.
Putting the question of brain aside, we already use
a lot.
Animal heart valves and not a complete organ.
Skin? Are there skin grafts also at this point? Is that something that we're doing?
I read they're working on it.
That I don't know exactly where that is, but it's certainly been normative medical care for many years to put in
heart valves.
Bovine and porcine heart valves.
Sure.
I mean, that's long gone. So is there a difference between a heart valve and a whole heart?
Right. Does that, if it's not working without, does that become an essential part? 100%. I think there was some discussion about research, correct me if I'm wrong, I haven't seen this for a long time, about pigs.
Yes, I'm just wondering if that
was there is
a discussion.
It's like... there have been. I've seen it, but like in the end, if you're saving a life, there's not really a halachic discussion to be had. It's just kind of awkward.
It's not kedera hachila. I mean, you can say that.
That's right. But I'm saying even if it weren't, we're talking about these as life-saving procedures mostly at this point. And so, but it's awkward culturally to think about these things.
Necessarily, and sometimes there are alternatives. So do you pick that, the pig valve over the alternative artificial valve?
It's very interesting.
There are definite medical reasons and situations where you recommend one or both of the other.
Right, so it may in the end not be subject to halachic analysis, but if all things are equal, there's a very interesting discussion about this. I mean, in general, it touches on a larger question, which is as follows. How do we understand the significance in halacha and Jewish thought more broadly of imbibing non-kosher foods? Right. If we think that these are just prohibitions from the Torah, so as soon as it's not kederech achila, it's not the normal way of eating, so then it might seem odd for a Jew to have... to have a non-kosher animal and chazir treif as part of my body, that seems a little unusual. But in the end, from a strictly halachic perspective, it's not something I'm eating. But if I think that these somehow taint the Jewish soul or something more like a mystical or Kabbalistic kind of approach, then already you might say, well, it's a little bit less kosher, forgive me, right? Because what we're doing is we're taking something that's somehow incompatible with Jewish purity or the Jewish soul or something like that, and we're now incorporating it as part of who I am. So is that how we think as halachists or no? We're rationalists, and that's just a bunch of bubba mices. But, and in the end, then you have the medical point that Pius Mignot is right as well, which is that if there's a strong medical preference, then we may set aside these considerations. But they're actually...
The emotional is so strong. I have a t-shirt with a pig on it, and I never wear it in front of Jews, but if I do, everybody comments, what? How can you wear... A pig on your
right.
Aren't you
it's
kosher.
Yeah, it's interesting, and this even has halachic ramifications. It's fascinating. You know, the Gemara talks about not raising pigs in Israel. Now, nowadays, it's more complicated, and there's a big shaila about this. Actually, it's a very interesting discussion, and you will not find, to best of my knowledge, from kibbutzim datiim that raise swine. It's not just culturally uncomfortable, but many poskim will say it's halachically problematic. Now, the question is that just because we're concerned people are going to come to eat it, or is it because somehow chazir is inconsistent with the sanctity of Israel? So that's a real, it's not just purely culturally, but the cultural and the mystical and the halachic, they kind of merge at a certain point. But it's a fascinating kind of question. Is an issue. By the way, in terms of non-kosher food, some poskim say, well, it's because it's not healthy. But problem with that is there's plenty of non-healthy kosher food. I mean, that seems to raise some basic questions about Jewish culinary practice that seem to fly in the face of some very deeply rooted cultural realities. So, there's a fascinating set of questions there. Anyhow, so there's a whole host of issues there about instead of the modern solutions, and then aside from animal transplantation, you have now just artificial kinds of hearts that they're working on. There's now, they now had, I think, the first transplantation of successful transplantation of an artificial heart.
It's been for a long time used.
What?
It's been used for a long time. They have a lot of different side effects. What is more recent is it used to be used as a bridge to transplantation. If you had somebody who was so mm-hmm. sick, they wouldn't survive until they could have a transplant.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But now it's used in certain situations for people who are inappropriate
mm-hmm.
for transplant for various reasons as a long-term solution, which leads to a whole bunch of other halachic issues, mm-hmm. like at what point do you turn it off? It will keep ticking.
Right. Yeah.
Pretty much forever. So that's a whole.
Yeah, in this new 100% in this new book by Rabbi Jason Wiener, this chaplain in L.A. He's got a whole chapter. This is a case study of the end of life care and the external heart or the artificial heart transplantation. So you have all of these kinds of questions that he discusses there.
It's huge.
Yeah. Okay. Anyhow, so but to come to this discussion, so what the poskim though focused really a lot of their energy on, especially starting in the early years, and you'll see now it's really shifted, but it raises a core halachic question, which is as follows. We know that there is not only a preference and not even a strong preference, but a halachic obligation that if I see an individual in danger of losing one's life, about to drown, so on and so forth, I am halachically obligated to save that life. Not only am I halachically obligated to save that life, but as we'll see in a moment, the Gemara says that if I could save the life by, for example, spending a considerable sum of money, I'm obligated to do that as well. How much we could discuss, but even a financial investment is necessary. Okay, so let's grant all of that. But then the question becomes, okay, that's fine in terms of if it comes at no risk to me, but what if I'm physically, in one way or another, putting my own life, possibly at least, on the line? How far do I need to go? Presumably, I don't have to put myself in the way of certain danger. If the level of my own danger is the equivalent of the other individual, presumably I'm not obligated to do so. To exchange one life for another seems like it's a very strange thing to say. And perhaps it's not even permissible, one might well argue, because after all, we saw the case of the flask in the desert, going back to that. And we said, I have an obligation to prefer my own life to that of someone else. If there's a flask and only one of us can enjoy it, certainly if I already have that flask, we say, why is your blood better than mine? Why should I give up your life instead of mine? I have an obligation to protect myself and so on. So presumably the parameters are, if I put myself in no danger whatsoever, then I have an obligation to jump into the water. If I'm a triumph lifeguard and I know what I'm doing, I'm going to go and try to save a life. Fine, that's a pretty straightforward case. Right? Even if I have to expend some sort of significant financial resources there as well, the same kind of halacha. On the flip side or the other end of the spectrum, if I'm putting myself in at least the same level of danger, then presumably it's certainly not obligatory and probably halachically problematic, as heroicism might seem. Which is culturally interesting, because we tend, and I think a very beautiful way, to extol the values of someone who's willing to take a bullet for someone if you really care for someone. I take a bullet for you. From a halachic perspective, as laudatory as that sounds, it's not simple, which is interesting to think about. But either way, okay, what about the case when I'm putting myself in a small percentage of doubt? What if I'm putting myself possibly in harm's way, but the flip side is that my friend will certainly die, God forbid, in this particular scenario? So what are the parameters of that? And in the early years, in the 1960s and the 70s, when poskim such as Eliezer Waldenberg and Rav Yitzchak Weiss, who is also one of the great halachic decisors of the 20th century, when they dealt with these issues, this was the question that they began to grapple with. And this becomes, in of itself, a major halachic dispute, and there's a tremendous literature. So we're going to look at some of that. So for instance, if you take a look at starting at source, too. So I gave you the obligation to save a life, which is derived from the pasuk of Lo Tamor Adam Re'echa. A pasuk in Parsha Kedoshim. Do not literally, they say profit by, but we understand it as essentially, do not stand by idly as your friend is going to pass away. And even the addition of Ani Hashem, which some of the Midrashim suggest, you know, the way that others might perceive my actions is different than what God knows. Sometimes I can notice a situation, fail to intervene, no one else can see, and the pasuk adds, but God knows the difference. In the end, if we see something and we can stand up, we can be an upstander and really make a difference, HaKadosh Baruch Hu knows, and so we should keep that in mind in our decision-making as well. And then the Gemara in Masechet Sanhedrin comes along, and the Gemara tells us, Gufa, the Gemara says, we had a previous halacha, which the Gemara comes back to. So where do we derive the halacha? That if I see my friend who's drowning in a river, is being dragged away by a wild animal, or these bandits who are coming to attack such an individual, then I have an obligation to save my friend. Tamud Lomar, so the Pasuk comes to teach us, Lo Tamud Adam Reyacha, that there's what? There's an obligation. Again, this is where the Gemara says that that verse is the source of the halacha, that I'm obligated to save a life. So, sorry about the distractions, I apologize. They are better than when it's the music room next door, as you know. But I'll have you know, we're very much hopeful that the construction will be finished in time for next year, for sure. And we are also, God willing, going to have the music room is going to have a whole music center, I hope you all know, which is going to be beautiful and strategically situated, and I suspect that they're probably going to be moving my office to be embedded within the music room just for old time's sake. Why not give me some extra reward in the world to come, hopefully, in lieu of the very minor trade-offs here. Anyhow, so I appreciate everyone's sticking with it. My daughter and her lab school classmates went yesterday to check out the construction. It was safe at the time. Don't worry, they worked it out. They are actually had a whole unit about topography and about construction in relation to Israel also, sort of an interdisciplinary unit, and they actually went on site to learn more about how construction works and brought it back to their classroom. So they actually went and examined the place where the classroom will, God willing, be standing, and then they went back and they took back the information with them. It's a lot of fun. So there are some joyous moments along the way with the distractions. Very cute. Okay, so the Gemara says, wait a second, hold on. You tell me that the obligation to save my fellow person's life derives from the verse, Lo Tamud Adam Re'echa, it's not true. And the Gemara is a very interesting reading of the obligation now to return a lost object. V'hamehacha nafka, the Gemara says, wait a second, is this derivation really derived from here? Mehatam nafka, it comes from somewhere else, namely, Avedat gufo minayin. The Gemara says something fascinating. How do we know that one must help his neighbor who may suffer the loss of body or health? Avedat gufo. That's a very interesting halakhic category. Gemara says, I know that if someone loses an object and I find it, then I'm obligated to announce it to ensure that it's returned to its rightful owner. We all know about Hashavat Aveda, the mitzvah of returning a lost object. With that, we're familiar. What about the obligation, however, that if I see a person, him or herself, about to suffer bodily harm, that there's similarly an obligation to help and restore not just the physical object, one's property, but a person, as it were, him or herself, as it were. Fascinating. Gemara says, Talmud Lomar, we learn this from the verse. The verse states, Vashevotelo, you should return it to himself. So the Pasuk says, a very interesting, careful reading, Vashevoto. That means to restore him. So Gemara says, well, what does it mean to restore him? So I might have answered that we know that certainly in the age of capitalism, that there's a lot of psychological literature about the notion that we tend to view our possessions as an extension of ourselves. If our possessions in general, then certainly, right, our smartphones and such devices in today's world, there's a substantial literature about how we actually view these things as part of who we are. That's a fascinating, not just iPhones, but really in the post-capitalist age. It's very interesting. The Gemara, I guess, is pre-capitalism. The Gemara says that we're not talking about one's property, we're talking about actually oneself, to return myself to myself. What does that mean? The Gemara says it means to restore my health, or to save me from bodily harm. So the Gemara says, wait a second, the obligation to save my friend does not derive from the verse of Lo tamid adam re'echa, standing idly by, it's from restoring my friend to him or herself, as it were. So Gemara says, from here we learn that I'm not only obligated to save a life, but also to spend money. Ime hatam hava mina, if the obligation to save my friend derived from that verse, I might have thought that hani mili bin avshe, says the Gemara, that this only applies to someone who is in danger by himself. In other words, if I can save my friend without anyone else's intervention, I have to jump into the water to save the person from drowning, but that's all. Avol mitrach, but to bother myself, to distract and to consume my time, umegar agure, to go and to expend money to get someone else to come and save in life, and presumably this is not only in case of drowning, because it's going to be hard to intervene quickly enough, but if there's some other intervention that could be effected through spending money, I might have thought that's a mitzvah, it's a good thing, but not a strict obligation. Where it says, no, kamash milan, that's an obligation, I have to do that as well. So this is the source we were talking about earlier. There's an obligation to save someone myself and to expend money in order to do that. Now, then the question becomes the question, okay, what about putting myself in a scenario of bodily harm? And that's going to be the next source.
I just have a question. Suppose it's not Chaveiro, his neighbor.
Yeah.
Suppose it's a stranger that you don't know?
Great question.
Do you still have the same obligation?
So I'll give you a hard...
And what if that stranger is not Jewish?
I'll give you the... Oh, yes, that's what I figured. Yeah, so I'll give you the hard, honest answer. The hard, honest answer is as follows. The term chaver is clearly a metaphor for not just my actual friend, but for my fellow Jew. Crystal clear. Okay. Now, does this verse include another Gentile? That is the subject technically of dispute. Okay, whether or not it technically includes it, but I will add critically that it's very clear that whether or not that comes from this technical verse, that there's clearly an ethical obligation. I feel very strongly for that. Does it come from this Gemara? I'm not convinced, not necessarily. Right? Does it come from a larger Jewish ethics? I think so. But there seems to be a sense in which my obligations towards someone who's considered to be part of my larger environs, as it were, part of my community, does somehow come first. This is a subject of major ethical disputes nowadays. Many say, well, what do you mean, universal ethics, and how come it's discriminatory? But it's more complicated than that. I can value the life of my fellow Gentile 100%, but still say that I have an immediate obligation to my larger family nexus, including my nation, my people, that comes first. And as uncomfortable as that might sound at first glance, the truth is, most people would say that if my child and another and my friend even were drowning, that I would have the right to decide and maybe even an ethical obligation to put my family member first. So I would see this as not an instance of discrimination per se, but rather an acknowledgement that when it comes to charity, when it comes to acts of goodness, that we have prior responsibilities to our more immediate concentric circles than the outside ones, even though that's not meant to, God forbid, devalue the life of any other human being. That's how I would see it. Okay, what about putting myself in harm's way? So check out this next story in the Gemara. And this is going to become the source for the halakhic authorities' discussions of what do we say about this intermediary case? Am I A, permitted, B, obligated, right, or none of the above, or is it prohibited for me to put myself in what the poskim will call safek sakana, a doubtful danger, in order to save my friend from Vadai sakana, from certain danger. So whatever the percentages are is not necessarily meant clearly defined, but let's assume my friend will almost certainly pass away, and there's a much smaller chance that I will pass by putting myself in harm's way in order to save my friend. That's the scenario we're talking about. We're not talking about physical suffering that might come to me as a result of this. That's part of the cheshbon, part of the calculus. We'll come to that a little bit later. Right now we're talking about what is the likelihood that either of us will ultimately give up our lives. So the Gemara tells the story. It's Yerushalmi. So the Yerushalmi says that apparently Rabbi Imi, that Rabbi Ami, who was one of the Amoraim, was one of the rabbis at the time of the Gemara, Itzir b'sif sifa. Now, this is a very interesting phraseology and a very colorful kind of Gemara. Itzir literally is an Aramaicized form of the Hebrew word tzad. Tzad is one of the 39 melachot in Shabbat, one of the 39 prohibited categories of melacha, and it means to hunt. except usually we talk about hunting, we're talking about with animals. He was hunted, as it were. He was captured in Safsifa, which is a reference to some sort of incredibly dangerous area. There used to be these bandits all over the roads. The Gemara talks about quite regularly. Tzvilat HaDerech was very popularly recited, and it was considered to be very, very dangerous. So there was maybe there were bandits, whatever it might have been, who captured Rabbi Ami. So Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish, who were two friends originally, they were antagonists, but ultimately they become chavrutot and very dear friends. They were also close with Rav Ami, and their colleague, a great one of the Gedolei Hador, had been captured. And they debate and they raise the question, the grapple, what should we do? Should we try to intervene to save him? So Amar Rabbi Yonatan, okay, so Rabbi Yonatan, other versions, it appears Rabbi Yonatan, but we think it's Rabbi Yochanan, so I'm going to say Rabbi Yochanan. So he says, and I give that to you in the English, Yikare Chameit Besadino. Okay, that's colorful and blunt. They were much more blunt back in the day. That's how the Gemara was. Many of the passages of the Gemara wrap the dead in his shrouds, which is an honest way of saying, look, there's nothing we can do to intervene. Maybe there'll be a miracle, maybe not, but there's nothing that we can or ought to do to intervene. We'll put our own lives on the line by trying to save some other life. In the end, probably both will be killed. What are we going to have accomplished? Amar Rabbi Shimon Reish Lakish. Reish Lakish responds. He says, I don't care. I'm going in. I'm taking a bullet, as it were, for my friend, for my colleague. Ada ana katil, ana mitzkatil. I will either kill or be killed. I'm going in. On the ezel mishizivle b'chayla, I'm going in with might, either with armed forces or with some sort of physical brute force, and I'm going to try to save him. Right? Umishiziv is Aramaic for hatzala, oh shizava. In the Sephardic Kaddish, ushizava is actually one of the words there where we ask God to save us. So that's the Aramaic etymology of the word. So this seems to be a fascinating kind of dispute. And many have interpreted that this is not just because these are Amoraim, so it's not just sort of a psychological or emotional response, but that there's actually a halachic tug and pull that's taking place, right? How much danger can I be willing to put myself in danger? And then the question is also, what did Reish Lakish really mean? Did Reish Lakish really mean he's going to put himself in full-fledged 100% danger in order to save someone? Do we really think halachically there's justification for putting myself in absolute definite harm's way in order to save someone else? The simple reading of the rest of halachic literature is really probably not. But then how do we read Reish Lakish? So many come along and they say, no, what Reish Lakish is saying is not that he's literally going to put himself in certain harm's way. What's he going to put himself in?
Possible.
That's right. And then the dispute becomes, okay, is it halachically permissible to put myself in a scenario of suffix sakana, of possible harm's way, in order to save my colleague, who is in a case of vadai sakana, who's certainly in harm's way? In other words, is it possible that they are grappling with exactly this core question that then may animate later discussions? Here you have a discussion from the 4th century, roughly, and it's going to animate a discussion in the 1960s, 1970s about, okay, is it the same thing? Can I put myself in a scenario of living organ donation in order to save my friend's life?
Wasn't Reish Lakish a bandit?
Initially, yes.
So, isn't...
I was alluding to that earlier when I said that they were,
so
yeah.
So is it another way to look at this possibly? Maybe for Rabbi Yochanan,
good.
It was certainly...
Oh, that's... I was going to say something else. That's
but
it.
Reish Lakish, you know, had a certain skill set.
That's
that
right.
That might allow him to pull this off.
Yeah.
That Rabbi Yochanan lacked.
That's right. And I think it's... it's. I was going to say it in a different way in terms of... whether or not the Howie Paskin, as it were. That's an interesting way of saying it. I was going to suggest that maybe the Gemara is... because the question is, who do we Paskin like? Right? What's the halacha? Who do we follow? So it's an interesting thing. The Yerushalmi doesn't say. It's a dispute. But if the contemporary question of certain kinds of donations actually hinges on whether or not I can put myself in suffix sakana to save someone else from... vadai sakana, then it's really important to know how we rule. And it's not like Shulchan Aruch just comes along and clearly says, well, this is the halacha. It's not so clearly decided. So it's a fascinating kind of question. Now, there's a tension here, because on the one hand, Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish usually pass them like Rabbi Yochanan, all things being equal. But at the same time, who gets the final word? right? It's Reish Lakish. The Yerushalmi goes on to other discussions here, but you kind of get the sense of, right, Reish Lakish is like brushing him aside and saying, look, like, if you want to wimp out, then fine, that's up to you, but I got this. Right? So I was going to say in that context, but Pai, I think in light of your point it made, you can add to that. You can say, yeah, the point is that, is it even a dispute at all? Right? Maybe everyone would agree that you can put yourself in a suffix, kind of, except that what? Okay, some of us are more likely to be successful than others. If it's a kamikaze mission or you're just not trained, you don't know what you're doing, don't waste your time. But if you actually think that you are the Mossad and you can swoop in and get the Ethiopian Jewry out and they may actually, a significant percentage might survive, then maybe it's worth it to go ahead with this operation. And these are the kinds of calculations. I think that that could be part of it.
Well, the Israeli army, of course, with their no man left behind policy, sure, faces this issue all the time
in that kind of context. Yeah, that's right. It becomes really, it's complicated there also, because that's a tension in terms of how we look at saving lives. Do we look at this one individual life, or are we looking at the broader morale of the army? And the rationale for a seeking to save even that one life is not so much or only for that individual, but what it says about who we are and what our values are as Tzahal. So in a sense, it's something broader. It's very interesting. There are also, by the way, there are opposite scenarios that are relevant to medical ethics from a different angle. When I was in Einstein previously, my first year, the president of the Shul community was a Yored, who at least temporarily came for medical school. He's now back in Emin Aliyah and went back to Israel. And I served as an Israeli officer. And so when we have these kinds of conversations about medical ethics issues, he would raise parallel questions that would come up in Sahel, these kinds of scenarios. So he said, don't worry, getting all in. So he said, do you have some mind? Thanks. You can say it was for me, okay? If you want, you always can. So here was the scenario. Scenario was as follows. Where he told me the following, which I didn't know previously. Let's say there's an Israeli soldier who is captured. And they run the risk now of having a captive scenario, of having pidyon shvuyim type of case like we've unfortunately experienced. So he said, once he is captured, this is terrifying, he said that there's a code red that comes into effect, and the job of that platoon is twofold. Ideally, save his life. If that's completely implausible, their charge is to ensure that he dies. This is horrifying. This is the counterpart. I couldn't believe it. And I don't know if it's still in place, but at least in 2009 or 10 or whenever it was that I heard this, this was the policy in Sahel, that their obligation is to ensure that he dies if need be, because it is safer for the entirety of Sahel for that individual to die than for whatever number of soldiers that there will be pressured to. Something else could happen to them if they are taken, because what it does is it incentivizes our enemies to take more, and then there are going to be terrorists who will be pressured to be released by the families of this individual for understandable reasons. We've seen that scenario, and that ends up being worse, more dangerous for the army and for Israel. So there's a flip side to that. Very, very hard ethical questions.
They changed something after Gilad Shalit, was it? Was captured. Remember 2 years ago, or was it three already, was the summer Lebanon war?
Maybe they changed this policy.
When they weren't sure yet whether, I think it was the boy from Herzliya or somewhere, who is still missing actually, they have some sort of new protocol in terms of when someone goes missing during some sort of an action.
Mm-hmm. I don't remember. We can look at else. We can look it up. It's possible. Again, that's a little bit dated.
Yeah.
And there's been a lot that,
right.
Mm-hmm. Been a lot that's gone on that subject, unfortunately, since that time. So it could well be. Anyhow, okay. So here you have this exchange, and the question is, indeed, how do we paskin? And so, what is the halacha of this scenario of suffix sakana to save someone from avada sakana? And along come a number of the commentaries, and they make a number of observations about this one. The first one is in Source 5. This is from some by the name of the Smar. The Sefer is known as the Smar, the Sefer Mirat Inayim. This is one of the classic commentaries on the Torah and great codification of Halakha. And the Smar comes along, and he says, you know, that the Hagahot Maimoniot, he points out, Hagahot Maimoniot is one of the commentaries on the Rambam. And the Hagot, Maimoniot, he cites this story of Rabbi Yochanan Reish Lakish that we just saw, and he says two things. Number one, his interpretation of this scenario is that it is a case of suffix sakana, save someone from a vada, sakana number one. In other words, the way that we propose reading it, as sort of this intermediary case, is how he reads it. That's where I'm getting it from. And number two, as he points out from the Beit Yosef, Rabbi Yosef Karo, from the author when the works of the Shulchan Aruch, he says that the conclusion of the Yerushalmi seems to be like Reish Lakish. And he gets the final word, that seems to be the halakha, that one is at least permitted, if not obligated, at least permitted to put oneself in Safek Zakan. He actually says one must. That's what it seems. It's Sarach. It seems one ought to do so. Well, or even one must do so. And the explanation that he offers, I'm going to pick it up on the fifth line. He cites the Beit Yosef, the Chasav is Elishonon, he wrote, and this is his comment, Venira, and it would appear, Shatam, who, the reasoning is, Mipnei Sha'Allah Vadai V'hu Safek, because one guy is Vadai, one guy is Safek. In other words, the only case where we say that the two lives are equal, and therefore who am I to put myself on the line instead of my friend, is when the two scenarios are roughly approximate in terms of the level of risk. But if the level of risk is considerably different, then my friend's life outweighs my own, not because the life itself is more valuable, of course, but because of the difference in likelihood. Okay, but then he makes another observation. He says, you know what? Isn't it interesting that although the Beit Yosef, which is the precursor to the Shulchan Aruch, in other words, the same Rav Yosef Karo, who's living in the 1500s of Tzfat, who's writing the Shulchan Aruch, who first writes a longer compendium called the Beit Yosef, Yosef Karo, and then out of that, the Shulchan Aruch that we have nowadays is basically what he called a shorthand version of his longer halachic treatment. He actually held the Beit Yosef, very interesting, Rav Yosef Karo writes explicitly, the Beit Yosef was his magnum opus. He says, if you really want to know the halacha, you want to read this whole book. But the Shulchan Aruch, of course, became popularized as the code of Jewish law for a very simple reason. Beit Yosef is, 7 to 8 to 9 to 10 times longer than the Shulchan Aruch. It's just too much. Shulchan Aruch is 4 huge volumes. It's so significant in its own right. And then now we have all the commentaries on top of it. So it's just too long. So the Shulchan Aruch, either way, he says, the same Beit Yosef who said that in Yerushalmi there's a debate, and the ruling of the Yerushalmi is that I'm obligated to put myself in doubtful danger or to save my friend from certain danger, the very same Rabbi Yosef Karo omitted this halacha from the Shulchan Aruch. Why? Why do you leave it out? Aha. Must be that he held that's not halacha. He says, Gam zehi shmito ha-mechaber umoram zal, which stands for the Rambam. Right? So, so he says, Uvazei yishlomar kevan, excuse me, sorry, moram is the Rambam of Moshe Isselis. Uvazei, and the Rambam in a second. Uvazei yishlomar kevan shaposkim harif. This is Rabbi Yisrael Kalfasi, who was the great halachist from Fez, Morocco, living in the 11th century. Vaharambam, the Rambam himself. Vaharash, Ratur. All the great subsequent poskim, they all omitted it. Lohivio, Bifiskim, Shemach Yishmitu, Gamkin. Shachar says, look, the Yushami has its discussion, its conclusion. But that's not apparently what any of these people paskin. Not the Rif, not the Rambam, not the Rosh, not the Tur, not the Shulchan Aruch himself, because the Shulchan Aruch was looking back and said, none of these people accept this. Apparently, we don't paskin like it. Okay, that's very nice. Except, usually, if you have a machlokes between the Talmud Yerushalmi, okay, the Israeli Gemara, basically, okay, which is the counterpart, the Israeli counterpart to the Talmud Bavli, the Babylonian Talmud, which is the one we generally learn. If you have an argument between one of the two Talmudim, two Gemaras, and Rishonim, and medieval commentaries, what's the halacha generally? All things meet equal. Right? Usually we would follow the Yerushalmi. It's an earlier, weightier, previous source. So what gives? What rights do we have to discard the Yerushalmi's conclusion on the basis of later commentaries? And it just begs the question, why did the later commentaries leave this out? It's very strange. So there's, if you take a look at source number 6, wrong way, so there's an explanation. The Aruch Laner, who is one of the Achronim, one of the later commentaries, he has the following insight. He says, you know, remember that Gemara that we read initially, the Gemara in Sanhedrin? What did the Gemara say? The Gemara said that there were two sources. He's going to make a deal. He's going to have a careful reading of that Gemara from which he will extrapolate that actually the other Talmud, the Bavli, Talmud Bavli that we read earlier, disagrees with the conclusion of the Yerushalmi. That's his argument. What's the argument? Because remember, what did the Gemara do? What did it say? Had two verses on the basis of which we're obligated to save a life. What were they? Lo samal adam riacha, number one, can't stand by idly. And what was the other one that we saw? Right, it was the obligation of returning not a lost object, but returning a life, right? Returning a life, a person to him or herself, right? Okay. Now, what did the Gemara answer to that? Why do we need two verses, the Gemara had said, right? What did we say? Not only am I obligated to save the life myself, but I'm even obligated to do what?
Hire workers.
To hire workers, right? Right, exactly what the Gemara says, Louis, right. What did the Gemara choose not to say? What could the Gemara have said? What would have been a plausible alternative if the Bavli really agreed with the Yerushalmi? A very sharp insight. Very Talmudic reading. Gemara. What could the Gemara have said? Not only I get money, right? What am I obligated to even do to place myself personally in danger, in harm's way? Did the Bavli say that? No. It just said, I have to go and save. Okay, assuming there's no danger, presumably. And I even have to spend money. Hopefully for the Gemara, human life is more significant than some money. Now, we know the Gemara is honest about this. The Gemara says there are two types of people. There are people who value their lives more than their finances, and there are people for whom the inverse is true. The Gemara is very honest about our psychological shortcomings as human beings, but that's not the Gemara's own value system, right? It says it about Kriyat Shema. B'chol levavcha, b'chol nafshecha, b'chol miyodecha. Right? So you have to be willing, the Gemara says you have to be willing to give up your life or give up your money. So the Gemara says, why do you have to say both? So the Gemara says, right, it's almost like, you know, like, does the Gemara have a sense? If you were absolutely, if anyone asks you, is the Gemara, absolutely, this is a great instance. Are there some people who value their lives more than their financial resources, and there are people who value their finances more than their lives, so be it, that's just human nature, okay? The Gemara gets it, totally on task, fine. So the Gemara understands that's human nature, but if you ask the Gemara, what do we value, what does halacha value, the answer is obviously human life. So the fact that the Bavli does not take the opportunity to say that I am obligated to even save my friend from certain danger in order to put myself in placing myself in possible danger would seem to indicate that I'm not obligated to do so. In other words, put differently, that the Bavli disagrees with the Yerushalmi. Right? You see, this is very striking. So that even though it's true that according to many authorities, that Talmud Yerushalmi, based on Rish Lakish's story, had concluded that I am obligated to place myself in definite harm's way or save my friend from doubtful harm, the Bavli disagrees and says I'm not obligated to do so. And that is the argument of the Aruch Laner in shorthand form.
Not obligated,
form.
But you are permitted.
Ah, unclear. Very good. Great question. He doesn't say that we can't prove that. Because all the psukim we're talking about here, lo saman odam reyecha, and vahashevoselo, returning not just the object, but returning a person to him or herself, these are all about obligations. You're not permitted to stand idly by. You're obligated to return the lost object. Am I permitted to opt to do so? Open question. So according to this, what we've said is that according to the Yerushalmi, I may be obligated to do so, but according to the Bavli, I'm certainly not obligated to do so. Am I permitted to do so? Open question. We don't know yet. And that becomes the subject of subsequent dispute as well.
Oh my gosh, the options are...
Options are wide open, right? Isn't that unbelievable? Must be Gemara. Okay, so right, I always tell my students, if you're not sure what the right answer is, you say machlokas on the quiz, you're in a good position. Of course, then when they say machlokas and it's wrong, they're doing me, but that's... not the first time that's happened. Okay, so that becomes a subject of dispute. But it's not totally wide open because what we've said now is that to say I'm obligated is off the table. So that's, I mean, that's, we said there might be three theoretical options that were expressed, but according to the direction that we're going in, we have two remaining primary options, and we're going to see that that's, that itself is the subject of some question. By the way, in case you're all wondering, the bottom line is that most assume that I'm actually, that, or put it this way, sorry, this question remains somewhat unresolved, but at least most, I would say that it might even be problematic. Most are not. If it's a significant percent, the question is, what's a significant danger? That's going to be the question, right? What does it mean, suffix sakana? But if it rises to the level of significant risk, there are many, many poskim more uncomfortable with it. Then the question becomes, what is significant risk? And that becomes the issue. And I would say there are many who say that 10% is a critical cutoff line. In halacha, the 10% line has a substantial... a substantial frame of reference as sort of distinguishing between a very small, relatively insignificant minority versus a more substantial, significant minority. The 10 to 50% place has sort of a privileged halachic status as a significant minority. You know, still, most of us tend to think that a 7% mortality risk is pretty high. So the question is, can you use that here? So I'd be careful before saying yes, but that is one of the numbers that's thrown out. But it gives you a sense to where this kind of the discussion comes from. Okay. If you take it, we're not going to focus so much on the Igros Moshe in Source 7, but Rav Moshe just has an interest. Igros Moshe is literally letters of Moshe. This is the Tshuvot, the response of Rav Moshe Feinstein. And Rav Moshe and just has an interesting argument here. He says, well, he says, maybe I can argue this question of Safik Sakana and Vadai Sakana from the general parameters. He says, let's say I have any prohibition in the Torah, okay, any Isser in the Torah. And if I, he says, I have the following scenario. Either I violate, he says, either I violate that Isser. If I violate that Isser, I'm going to definitely save my life. I'm sorry, if I violate that Isser, or in order to, sorry, but if I come to violate that Isser, I place myself, right, or need to place myself in harm's way, essentially. In other words, the point is that I have a choice between violating Avera and the possibility of mortal danger. What's the halacha? What do I choose? Do I violate? It's only a suffix sakana for me. It's a possibility that I'm going to pass. In order to save myself from that, I have to violate an avera.
Violate the
Israel. For sure. When I am, right, even comes to Shabbos. Let's say the person is not definitely going to die. There's a very small chance. Most cases are like that. Many cases are like that, right? I'm going to put some. It's Shabbos after, right? It's Friday night. I'm in my home. You know, there's something that happens. Thank God, in all likelihood, it's not life threatening. But you know what? In the back of my mind, I'm wondering, what do I do? Right? The answer is call right away. Right? You better call 911 immediately. If there's even a shred of a possible doubt in my mind that maybe a life is on the line, call, get them to the hospital in as safe and quick a way as possible. There's not a question. Right? I'm making a phone call. I'm going to forget it. There's a possibility, an outside chance. Whenever my judgment is that medically this is indicated, not only permitted to violate Shabbos to get the person to the hospital, I am obligated to do so. Period. End of story.
What if it's not life or death? What if it's just illness?
So then there are going to be different scenarios, and we have to figure out a limb and so on and so forth. So that's more subtle, but for our purposes, it's very, very clear. So Rav Moshe says, well, maybe I should say the same thing here. I mean, there's a mitzvah to save a life, for an iser not to stand idly by. So he says, maybe we should apply the same calculus and say, well, for some other avira or mitzvah, I'm not permitted to put myself in safek sakana. Maybe we should say the same thing here. And therefore, that's a proof that not only am I not right, that not only is it an obligation to put myself in doubt, harm's way, then maybe I'm not even permitted to do so. He says, well, maybe it's different, because as soon as you're talking about entering into harm, by definition, you're talking about a different kind of calculus. It's like many ethicists say that the ethics of war, not that anything goes, but you can't use regular civilian ethics in order to judge ethics of war, because it's just a completely different kind of ethical context. So that's the question of emotion. It's an interesting kind of scenario. I'm not going to read inside, but that's an interesting kind of back and forth. Okay. Now, that becomes sort of the foundation for the discussion where most people get it. Let's leave aside or make quick mention of source 8. This is Rabbi Akiva Iger. Rabbi Akiva Iger is one of the great latter-day halachic authorities, not so recent as Rav Moshe Feinstein. And he talks about this scenario of sort of a one in a thousand case. And he talks about actually this notion that if there's a one, he says, even in a one in a thousand case, he says, we can use the term danger to refer to it. So this just goes to the question we're talking about is, okay, what kind of likelihood is danger? And he seems to say, not in consonance, but I said it earlier, basically even one in a thousand is considered to be some sort of suffix sakana. Because when it comes to medical scenarios, right, one in a thousand is, right, that's still something that's a conceivable risk, right? We're talking about 0.1%. One in a thousand. I mean, if we had a decision to make, personally, and we were told there's a 0.1% of mortality, I mean, right? I think we'd probably take that rather seriously. I suspect that's not, oh, it's just some infinitesimal. No, that's a very serious thing. So that's just an interesting piece to this discussion. Okay.
He's also putting in a pain and suffering.
Yes, although that's a little bit, it's a little bit outside of this core issue, but I want to come to that in source 9, where that's going to be more obvious. Now, source 9 takes us back to the late Middle Ages, or the transition between the end of the Middle Ages and the early modern period. And this is a responsum of Rav David ben Zimra. Rav David ben Zimra was the chief rabbi of Cairo and its surrounding community in, let's say, the 15th century. And toward the end of the medieval period. And Egypt at that time was filled with, unfortunately, a lot of what we know during the medieval period, and it was a difficult type of scenario. He gets the following case. Hard to describe, but it is so impactful and so relevant, and in a way very beautiful, that it can't leave this out in context of our discussion. Here is a scenario. The ruler or some sort of governor at the time essentially puts someone in the community in the following scenario and says, basically, there's a Jew. You have a fellow Jew whose life is on the line, who's going to rot away in prison, and ultimately we're going to take his or her life. I think it was his life in that scenario. Or there's a friend who has to give up a limb. Hmm. Why? Because a cruel, evil, right, masochist, whatever it was. Okay, so that was the scenario. So this person who is placed in this impossible situation says, if I give up my limb, the doctors tell me that I'm most likely to live. I'm likely to live. He doesn't. I don't think he details exactly the limb, but he maybe he's given choice. He says, "I'm going to live, presumably," and that's the question. Okay, it's like one of those Holocaust response. All right, imagine being asked this question. Okay, so put yourself in this rabbi's place. So, what's the halacha? Very difficult. So at first glance, the questioner says, I feel like, this is a genuinely, I mean, it's beautiful to see, and it's a little bit humbling to see, the piousness of the individual. Because he says, I just want to know what the halacha is. Rabbi, if you tell me that I'm obligated to give up my limb to save a life, because after all, saving a life in halacha is such a high value. We say, pikuach nefesh, is docha Shabbos, so presumably it's docha a limb. That should be the halacha. It says, Rabbi, if you tell me that's what I'm obligated to do, that's what I'll do. Wow. So there's a certain kind of narrow halachic calculus that would lead us to think that, okay, I mean, saving a life. Okay, this guy's evil and a terrible anti-Semite and Yirmach Shemo and all of that, but that should be the halacha. The Radva says nonsense. That cannot be. It's inconceivable that halacha, which is a humane system, would demand of me that I sacrifice a limb in order to save a life. It's such excruciating, unconscionable, unimaginable suffering for this individual that it cannot be that I'm obligated to do so. That's his ruling. It's fascinating. And he says a couple of key things that are very relevant to our discussion. He says, in sakanat ever doche Shabbos, he says, one cannot violate Shabbat for the threat of a loss of a limb. That's true. Aval, however, sheavihu ha'ones alav mipnei chaviro, we have not heard, he says, we have not heard of an obligation for one to accept a threat instead of one's friend. In other words, we never heard that I'm obligated to give up my limb in order to save my friend's life. That we never heard that. Afal Gavi says, even though he's obligated to save him with his money, not with risking my limbs. Right? In other words, he kind of says, well, this goes back to the Gemara in Sanhedrin. Right? I have to pay money in order to save a life, but the Gemara had every opportunity to say that I'm obligated to give up a limb. Very similar to the argument that we saw from the Karen Ora earlier, who had made the argument and said, wait a second, the Bavli had every opportunity to say that I have to put myself in suffix as a Karen Ora, save my friend from Vali, so it should be the same thing. I'm obligated to, forget money, I'm obligated to give up my limb, save my friend. The Gemara didn't say so. Presumably it's because it's not halachically mandatory. And then he says, Vitsu moreover, furthermore, Dichtiv, it says in the Torah, Dorcheh Hadarchi Noam, that its pathways are ways of peace. Vitsarech Shemishpetei Torah Tinu, one is obligated that the laws of our Torah, Yumas Gimim Al HaSeichel, agree with rationality, Vasvara, and logic. Veichyal El Datinu, how can it possibly arise upon our thinking, Shiania Chadam, that the Torah will allow a person, or require of a person, L'Sameh Tino, to blind his eye, or L'Chatochet Yado Raglo, to cut off my hand or my foot, Kedei that they don't kill my friend, it cannot be hilkach. He says, therefore, I cannot see this reasoning of anyone who would rule that I'm obligated to give up my limb in this case. Elo, he says, midat chasidur. If you want to be a pious individual, that's up to you, and the Torah will be in reverence of your sacrifice. Right, of basically everything short of martyrdom. And he says, wow, as someone who has the strength to withstand this sort of test or scenario, wow, do I revere such an individual. But then he says, what about suffix sakana? If it's not just a limb, but it's putting my life on, he says, that's not allowed. And this is what I said earlier, that most Muslims are not allowed, in part based on this red vase. He says, if it's suffix sakana, to save my friend from vale sakana, all bets are off. Not even allowed to do that. Torah doesn't permit it. Yesh suffix sakana nefashahar, he's a chassid shote, he's a pious fool. He says, don't do that. Tesveika didei adif mivale dechavrei. Explicitly on the question that we asked, he says, my suffix presents a greater responsibility than to me, personally, than my friend's scenario of doubt. So Red Baz has two crucial rulings. He says, even if it's not a scenario of loss of a limb, of loss of a life, it's just loss of a limb, even then I'm not obligated to do so. But when it comes to a possible loss of a life, that rises to a significant likelihood of risk, he says, they're already not only in not obligated to do so, I'm not permitted to do so. And indeed, in the 1960s, in Source 10, let me just have my eyes on the clock. In Source 10, Rav Yitzchak Weiss actually uses this as the basis for his ruling. And he says, in this scenario, I don't remember the exact year when this was published, but I want to say this is still in the 1960s. Rav Yitzchak Weiss actually says, and he cites the Radvaz in support of his ruling, and indeed this is going to be the basis for the halachic pesach. So let's do this. Time is pretty much up. So let's pause here. Let's next week, God willing, let's finish up these last two sources, give them the proper attention that they deserve, and we will see how all of the background that we have laid out lead directly to how the poskim deal with the contemporary question, or dealt with in the 1960s. It's clearly aligned, and then we will see how things begin to shift nowadays. And it's a really remarkable halachic story there as well. Go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm having a lot of trouble. From a medical perspective, understanding the Red Buzz.
Go ahead.
Because, even today, sakanat aver, I think we would say that it's suffix sakanat nefasha.
Mm-hmm.
And, you lose a limb.
Mm-hmm.
And how much more so then, when it was just like, some executioner just would lop off a limb. I mean, mm-hmm. I would think the danger of infection, bleeding to death would mm-hmm. be mm-hmm. real. So it seems to me that there's an inherent contradiction in mm-hmm. what the Red Vaz is saying. So mm-hmm. I'm having really
right.
a lot of difficulty understanding mm-hmm. what yeah. he sees as absurd.
Or to say that you can't violate Shabbat to save your limb.
Well, one, that you say that you can't violate Shabbat, but also at one point he says you can't risk sakanat nefasha, but I don't see mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's a great question.
It's a kind of nefashot, and even more so then.
Yeah, it is a great question, and in fact, it's a question that many have asked, and not only that, but the Gemara itself talks about actually violating Shabbat for Sakana Niver because it can pose a risk to life. So it's actually not only your question, many others asking, and it does come from the Gemara.
It's a life of suffering, even if you survive.
That's true, but from the perspective of the questioner, that was the questioner's question, and that was exactly the Rabbi's answer. He says, well, therefore we're not going to go. So look, it doesn't bother me so much, because I think what we're deriving from him is not, I don't think we're deriving our medical conclusions from the basis of 15th century, medicine, in Cairo medicine. So in other words, what we wanted for our purposes is really to extrapolate the halachic principles. Maybe if there were certain, maybe they actually had the surgeries and everyone, they had taken a foot and they were able to stem the tide and so on and so forth. So, and that could be. Maybe they really meant a finger rather than a foot. I don't know. An eye, is that necessarily? It's not so. Actually, Mara talks about the eye. It's complicated, but
that's you're dead. If you're blind, it's like you're dead, according to.
But not in terms of it doesn't go there. But it's not literal, so doesn't work quite that way. So, I think that there might be answers, and it could well be that it was medically plausible in that community at that time. It doesn't bother me so much because I'm using it as the basis for halachic conclusions rather than medical conclusions. So, I'm not impressed by it, but
no, I'm fine with it from that perspective. But even today.
I certainly do not mean to derive any medical conclusions from it whatsoever, and that disclaimer should be all over all of the recordings. So hopefully we all know that. Good. Everyone have a meaningful and wonderful Thanksgiving. I really hope that we're able to be appreciative and connected to our Jewish values as well. And I look forward to wrapping this up and moving forward next time. Shabbat.